It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad to have you along as we explore the early projects of a young architect of the 1890s who became a pioneer of modern architecture, buildings in concert with the natural world. The exhibit at the Racine Heritage Museum is called Right Before the Lloyd. And you can call in about Wisconsin's iconic architect, Frank Lloyd Wright. Join in with your question, your comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tim Samuelson is Chicago's first official cultural historian and curator of the exhibit. Tim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So these pieces in the exhibit come from your private collection. What draws you to Frank Lloyd Wright and his work as a cultural historian?
Well, I think even beyond being the cultural historian, there is what sets Wright apart beyond the physical building, is he created buildings that would push all of your emotional buttons when you saw them. How you respond to light, how you respond to space, how things relate to the environment. And so they're very seductive buildings, and it goes well beyond the buildings themselves. So I was hooked in even when I was a little kid. In fact, I remember going to the beach as a little kid, my mother taking me. There was a Wright building, and I asked about it. In fact, my mother said, oh, that's one of those Floyd Wright buildings. They're very strange. But then over the years, I studied Wright. I was fascinated by his early work. I was unfortunately on the scene when some of them were demolished or there were bad alterations. But I was there to carry away the pieces. So now they've landed in Racine at the exhibit, and it's concentrating on really early Wright things. That probably if Wright could strike me with lightning for showing some of these, he probably would. But they tell you a lot about what he developed from, and actually where you might look at these things and say, what? That's not Frank Lloyd Wright. You can actually see valuable lessons that he learned in those early days in each and every one of these pieces.
That's what I'm wondering. How does studying Frank Lloyd Wright's early projects inform what we see in his iconic modern architecture, you know, decades down the road later in his life?
Well, you can look in the exhibit. And in fact, we have a design that was never built. It was a competition design for the Milwaukee Public Library and Museum. And it's like something right out of classical Greece. Now, you'd never think of classical Greece being part of Frank Lloyd Wright, but he actually did a beautiful job of it with the dome and the beautiful classical columns. But one of the things that he was able to learn and he mastered is classical proportions that are ancient ideas and concepts that also push your buttons. He could synthesize this. We have an illustration of a house that's English Tudor. You'd say, well, what does that have to do with Frank Lloyd Wright? But when you think of English Tudor, an old English building, where you have that very structurally expressive exposed frame of rough wood and plaster infill, and you see that on many of Wright's buildings. And so Wright had an amazing mind. There's a cognitive issue to this, that he had a mind like human Google. So anything that he saw throughout his life in terms of architecture or styles, when he had a new creative project to take on, he could instantly synthesize all of these lessons of things that he saw and experienced and then make them something ideally suited to the project at hand. So we got a little bit of neurological science here as well.
When did Frank Lloyd Wright push emotional buttons in Wisconsin? Like, when did Wright become highly regarded in our state, his native Wisconsin?
Well, certainly Frank Lloyd Wright is Wisconsin's child, literally, because he was born in Wisconsin. And much of his early life was spent around the area of Spring Green, Wisconsin, and also in Madison. And it was certainly a career that branched out that he is not only Wisconsin's child, but as a child and growing up, he could be a contentious child. He could be an ornery child. And, of course, built his home and studio, Taliesin, near Spring Green on the old family grounds. And all even I would even say that part of his experience with the landscape of the rolling hills around Spring Green became part of that mental arsenal that he was able to deploy in his architectural work. So you can look at like the Guggenheim Museum, the great spiral museum in New York City. You've got a bit of Wisconsin built into there. You just don't outwardly see it.
Talking about the early years of Frank Lloyd Wright with historian Tim Samuelson, the curator for Racine Heritage Museum's new exhibit, Right Before the Lloyd. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Tim, one piece in the exhibit is a perforated wood panel from Wright's Harlan House in Chicago. Why is the Harlan House significant to Wright's career?
The Harlan House is kind of an interesting stepping point in Wright's career, where he was emerging as an independent architect. Now, he was working as an employee of the Chicago firm of Adler and Sullivan under the great architect Louis Sullivan, and he was under contract to work for them exclusively. But Wright was always out of money, spending more money than he had, and he accepted some side jobs, anonymous. In fact, he did them under the name of his friend and former resident of Racine, Cecil Corwin, so that his bosses at Adler and Sullivan didn't know he was doing them. And this Harlan House was a gorgeous house that really tells a lot what you would expect in Wright's later buildings, with broad overhanging roofs and interiors merging with exterior spaces and porches. The entrance is hidden on the side, not in the front. And it had beautiful wood panels in kind of a Sullivan-like ornament on the front that had geometric and organic patterns, big bursting oak leaves on it. And these were done secretly. Wright did not want Adler and Sullivan or Louis Sullivan to know he was doing work on the side.
Is that why you hear it called a bootlegged house?
He called them bootleg houses.
Okay.
Yes. Just like from the old Prohibition. And I can't tell you why he did this, but he built this one just a few blocks from Louis Sullivan's own house. Hello. So I think Sullivan was walking down the street and saw this, and there was a big confrontation, and words were spoken. Wright, when you leave here, I'll be with a blackened reputation. And Wright shook his fist and said, and I've got some blackening to do myself, Mr. Sullivan. Bang, out the door. And so launched the independent career of Frank Lloyd Wright. So the Harlan House burned in 1963, but architectural historians saved some of the fret sawn wood ornament that didn't burn up. It is restored and it's hanging on the wall in the exhibit. And so you can thank the Harlan House and Wright getting booted out of Adler and Sullivan for beginning his illustrious career.
Thank you so much for that story. Let's take a call now, John in Boaz. John, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. I would like to say that Frank Lloyd Wright is the reason why I became a carpenter and builder myself. It's because I came to Richland Center and I saw the warehouse, which he built in 1908, sitting there completely neglected and almost falling down. This was back in 1988. Now we're advocating for some help to this beautiful building because Frank Lloyd Wright was born in Richland Center.
John, thank you so much for sharing that personal story about becoming a carpenter and an early work, 1908 there. Tim, what would you like to add?
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up because it is indeed an amazing building. And yes, Wright was actually born in Richland Center. It was a heartbreaker to see that wonderful warehouse building falling apart. And I am greatly delighted and encouraged that there has been community, both support in the community and outside, for facilitating its restoration and repair. And every visit that I make to it, I see it often. It's wonderful to see work progressing on it. And I think the point that was made about, you know, you're starting your whole career by seeing that building, That's part of these intangibles and what Wright's work is all about. So, by gosh, these buildings do their job.
Tim Samuelson, our guide to the early works and influences of legendary Wisconsin architect Frank Lloyd Wright. The traveling exhibit at the Racine Heritage Museum is called Right Before the Lloyd. You can join in with thoughts and questions. The number to call, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. An exhibit underway at the Racine Heritage Museum, it highlights the youthful years of Frank Lloyd Wright's architectural practice at the end of the 19th century. It's decades before he became iconic to the architecture profession. Call in with questions, your comments about Frank Lloyd Wright, 800-642-1234. Tim Samuelson is curator of the Right Before the Lloyd exhibit. Tim, let's talk about the L that became the Lloyd. And you say that Wright previously went by Frank L. Wright and then started using his full name in the 1890s when he developed his own identity and attitude. What do you mean by that?
Well, Wright was kind of a work in progress from his early work when he first came to Chicago in 1886 to kind of spread his wings as an independent architect. And he was in a search to find his own approach to architecture and also to kind of find himself as a person. And, you know, you think of Frank Lloyd Wright with that very melodic, flowing, very dignified Frank Lloyd Wright. But perhaps even tellingly, in the early days of his architectural practice, he signed his buildings and the blueprints and the building permits very prosaically as Frank L. Wright. Doesn't quite have the ring to it that Frank Lloyd Wright does. But I think it's telling as well as somebody who finally in the 1890s found himself, his oversized personality came forward, his individuality as an architect, setting aside outward signs of past architectural influences and truly becoming himself. So the story of this show is those early years as Frank L. Wright. You will see buildings that are surprising, but you can attribute them to Frank L. Wright. Hmm. By the time he emerges in the late 1890s and he signs himself as Frank Lloyd Wright, that's where the exhibit stops.
A piece of that early story is devoted to Wright's mentor, Cecil Corwin. What influence did Corwin have on Frank Lloyd Wright?
I would say that Cecil Corwin, who actually was previously before coming to Chicago, a resident of Racine, his dad was the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church there. Now, Wright later hardly would ever speak anything good about another architect. The person who I think meant the most to Wright in helping him blossom as a person, as an architect, was Cecil Corwin, who was the kind of the chief draftsman of a Chicago architectural office that gave Wright his first job. As far as the style of Cecil Corwin, there is nothing about that in Wright's work. What was important about Corwin is he became Wright's best friend and mentor and supporter. They were friends. They communicated with each other. They shared ideas with each other. They explored the arts community in Chicago and architecture with each other. When Wright got booted out of Sullivan's office, Wright rents two small rooms in the Schiller Building in downtown Chicago, which he shares with Cecil Corwin. They worked together, could oversee each other's work, have conversations. And it's interesting that probably if you look in Wright's autobiography, he mentions Cecil Corwin more than anybody else and in an admiring, respectful way. And he's totally lost out of the picture. And so we love the idea with this exhibit to bring him back, and even Wright himself, just a few months before he died, talking to his associates at the Taliesin Fellowship, remembered Corwin as the best friend perhaps I ever had.
Cecil Corwin is the architect of record for a home in Racine, the Mitchell House, that you know well. And there's been that debate over the influence, some calling the Mitchell House a lost Wright design. What's your perspective on who designed the Mitchell House?
Well, there's many enthusiastic people saying that it's a Frank Lloyd Wright building or a lost Frank Lloyd Wright building. I think you can certainly give the influence of Wright to it. But I think in the typical case of where poor Cecil Corwin has gotten lost, there is a lot of research that you can back up and say that it's really a Cecil Corwin building. However, it was designed when Wright and Corwin were sharing the same small office. They would see each other's work on the table at the same time. They would have, sure, conversations. And so the Wright influence is there, but I would almost say it's a case of osmosis between the two. But as far as Wright being responsible for the job, I would give an emphatic no. And poor Cecil Corwin, he gets forgotten and left behind every time. And I could make a long case, which I won't take your time with, now we'd be on the radio for hours, to say that, come on, give Cecil some credit. He did the house, but there's certainly some right influences in it.
I'm going to reintroduce you at that. Tim Samuelson, curator for Racine Heritage Museum's exhibit underway. It's called Right Before the Lloyd, as we talk about the early years and influences of Frank Lloyd Wright. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Okay, so what about the fires? You have been able to restore some of the pieces and the structures that have been lost or damaged by fire. You know, how often has fire destroyed Wright's work? What is it with fire?
Well, there is this kind of force that hovers over Wright's head in terms of fire. The tragedy of his home in Taliesin burning twice. And there's even cases of Wright buildings catching on fire and being destroyed. One of the things that we have done with this exhibit, which I love the idea of taking historical materials in bringing them back to life with modern technology. The majority of the objects that we have in the show are the original pieces. They have been restored to their original color, but they were the ones that were on the buildings. Either they were obtained because of demolition or bad remodelings. However, there were some that were lost altogether, and we just had fragments of them. And Wright loved to do ornament made out of fret sawn perforated wood boards. And we have had cases of where all that was left of these designs were just little fragments, but just enough to figure out the design. And we have used laser technology to computers and laser technology to recreate these exactly. So now we have on the wall designs that people haven't seen in some cases 50, 60, even almost 100 years, all thanks to modern technology. But you can see them rather than a picture of it. You have the actual piece as close as we can get it to what it looked like when the building was built.
Oh, that's cool. Let's take a call. Tony in Sturgeon Bay. Tony, what's on your mind?
I have a personal story once removed about Wright. I had a dear friend named Don Erickson who was on a high school field trip to Taliesin, and the idea was to find out who they were going to accept into the school. And Don was rejected, and he came home totally dejected, and he told his dad that he didn't make the cut. And his father said, well, why don't you call up there and see if they'll make an exception? So it was a Sunday night late, and Don called at Taliesin. Somebody answered the phone, and he said, my name's Don Erickson. I was there for the trip, and I have to be an architect. And the gentleman on the phone said, well, then I guess you're going to be an architect. He said, well, what do I do?
And
he said, well,
we're getting... We're getting close here on time, Tony. What is the end of the story?
He said, come back tomorrow. And Don asked, who are you? And he said, I'm Mr. Wright. And it changed his life.
Oh, goodness. Tony, thank you. And we are out of time, Tim Samuelson. But so many stories that you unearth in this exhibit. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on. Great to talk about it with you.
Tim Samuelson, historian and curator of the exhibit Right Before the Lloyd, on display at Racine Heritage Museum into 2024. We have a link at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With the U.S. Supreme Court ending race-conscious college admissions nationwide, we get reaction from the publication devoted to national issues affecting higher ed on how schools will comply with this ruling and what it means for diversity on Wisconsin campuses. You can join in on a new era in admissions policies. Call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Eric Hoover is senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's look ahead here. What could be the immediate consequences of the Supreme Court's ruling on enrollment at colleges and universities?
Yes, the immediate consequence, particularly at selective colleges and universities, likely will be a downturn in the enrollment of underrepresented minority students. So that would be African-American students, Latino and Latina students, and Native American students. This is what some prominent institutions have seen happen over the last few decades when they have been forced to, in several states, including California and Florida and Michigan, when institutions have been forced to do admissions without being able to consider race. So if we're looking at what has happened in other parts of the country, that is likely to occur, at least to some degree, at many of the nation's most prominent, most sought after colleges and universities.
Can you give us some examples of materials or systems that colleges will need to change in order to comply with this ruling?
Yes, for sure. So there's going to be a shift. And so if you're not able to, as an admissions officer, look at an applicant's race, and you can't consider an applicant's race per se, right, the fact of someone's race, as a result of last week's Supreme Court ruling, then colleges are going to be looking at what are known as race-neutral factors. And so there'll be even greater attention paid to a student's socioeconomic status, right? Colleges will be digging more deeply into whatever information they can find, and there's plenty of data out there that would give them a sense of the opportunities a student has had or perhaps lacked, right? An applicant's high school, colleges want to know how many students there qualified for free and reduced lunch, for instance, or what is the neighborhood like demographically that applicants grew up in. These are not perfect measures. They have to be used carefully and ethically, but now is the time that colleges are going to have to drill down on measures of socioeconomic inequality and disadvantage. Instead of looking also at race, they're going to have to look at data that is often described to some degree as a proxy for race, among other factors. And so this mix of data is going to become more and more important over time.
When I hear you say that, I think about one of your articles you wrote on this, and one of your sources, I think they were saying how it's going to make the admissions process a lot harder and a lot more expensive. And I paused there because I didn't really understand how would it be more expensive under this ruling to bring in a more diverse class of students. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kate. And so this is based on, I can't remember who said that quote. It's been a long week.
Yeah.
If you look at the amicus briefs filed by the University of Michigan and the University of California, Berkeley, there's a lot of detail in there about how after there was a ban in each state on the consideration of race and admissions, those flagship institutions spent a lot of time and money trying to build and grow what we might call workarounds for not being able to consider race. And so some of those strategies involved creating new scholarships for lower income students. And not just, it's one thing to have a scholarship that might benefit a lower income student, but you have to go out there and meet with those students and meet with those families all throughout the state. And to have a presence in communities that perhaps many flagship institutions haven't had. And so in the case of the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, I think for a time anyway, they had created satellite offices, say in Detroit and perhaps in other areas of the state. I can't recall exactly, but it's not just enough to change your website and send students an email, particularly lower income, underrepresented students, many of whom do not have parents who went to college. And so this was outreach. This was communications. This
relationship building.
And relationship building. And that sounds quaint. It's especially important when colleges are trying to connect with underrepresented students, first generation students who might not have a very positive view about college, or they might just be deeply ambivalent about it and certainly wondering how they might afford it. Will they fit in? So yes, boots on the ground, it can be an effective strategy. It's also a time-consuming one and an expensive one.
Going back to 2003, the Supreme Court limited the ways that colleges could consider race in admitting students. Can you explain how universities have used race in recent years in deciding who to admit?
Yes. Well, since 1978, up until last week, colleges have been permitted to consider race in a limited way. So some people out in the universe might think that, there are a certain number of seats set aside for minority students. That is not the case. Or that there has been a quota system. That's not the case. Race is often described as being one of several factors in admission. So just one facet. For one applicant, it might be considered a tip or a plus. For another applicant, it might not be. And so it was a limited use. Race was generally not determinative in admissions decisions, but it was one factor that selective institutions used to get a sense of the overall picture of who that young applicant was. And race was considered along with all kinds of other attributes, talents that the applicant had, courses in which the applicant had excelled, the geography of where the applicant came from. That's something colleges consider, right? A university that recruits nationally, say like the University of Wisconsin, does not want to have all students just from like three or four states, right? It wants a mix of students. So race was one of many, many variables that selective colleges are considering, at least were so until last week.
Talking about the Supreme Court's ruling prohibiting colleges and universities from considering race and admissions, Eric Hoover with us, senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. You can weigh in, bring your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Eric, you mentioned these selective schools, highly selective, Ivy League institutions, Harvard, Yale. Is it those types of institutions or state universities like the University of Wisconsin more likely to be affected by this ruling?
Yes, it is. Those are the institutions that are will surely be most affected by this ruling. It has implications for perhaps for many institutions that are less selective. But of course, it's important to remember that, the majority of four-year colleges and universities in this country admit the majority, if not the vast majority, of their applicants, right? And so there's not this intense kind of competition for seats, often in limited supply. And there's not the same on the admission side, at less selective institutions. Generally, there's not the same fine grain, detailed consideration of all these attributes that a student might bring to your campus. There's not these lengthy committee meetings that go on for weeks and weeks, in which super selective colleges are trying to, as they will often say, craft a class or shape a class, you know, student by student. That's just not something that happens at the majority of institutions, even though those less selective and perhaps less famous institutions by and large certainly value diversity among their applicants and among their student bodies. But there's not that same kind of bottleneck of competition comparing this applicant to another and considering, you know, perhaps multiple, if not dozens of factors in each student's application at a certain point in the admissions process that you find at, you know, Madison or at Harvard or what have you.
So what about the ripple effect here? Could the ruling end up restricting race as a factor in, say, awarding scholarships or in the financial aid office?
That is a great question, and many people are asking it throughout the country, Kate. The immediate answer is, according to the legal experts I've been in touch with over the last week, the immediate answer is that there's nothing in the Supreme Court's decision from just a week ago today that seems to preclude a college from targeting aid, from using race-conscious financial aid and scholarship programs. The decision just doesn't deal with that question directly. So I think for now, I would say two things. Colleges and universities are probably fine to continue those race-conscious programs. However, we know we live in a litigious society. The same upwelling of opposition to race-conscious admissions policies that we've seen in this country for a half century or more is not going to abate all of a sudden just because there was a victory for critics and opponents of race-conscious admissions in the Supreme Court last week. So some institution out there, probably a big-name university, sooner or later will find itself on the receiving end of a lawsuit, perhaps about a different race-conscious policy on the campus. But we'll just have to wait and see if and when that occurs.
So, you know, as you say there, race and admissions has come up again and again in the courts. Will this victory spell the end, or is it opening the door to more litigation?
Yeah, I think when you look around the country, particularly in states such as Florida right now, I mean, they're an outlier, but there are other states on their heels. Florida has, I would say, basically declared war on all diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives within its public higher education system. And I believe a law restricting, if not more or less obliterating, diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts at Florida universities is just about to take effect. Maybe it's today or next week. You know, that is a full-scale opposition to race-conscious anything, really. And I think we're going to see that at least a handful of other states. So no, your good question, Kate. I think the answer is no. This is not the end. This is a continuation of a relentless, what appear to be a relentless series of attacks on anything that considers race, a program, a student service, and you name it, on some college campuses.
Chronicle of Higher Education senior writer Eric Hoover, our guide to changing college admission systems across America, moving toward race-neutral admissions following the landmark Supreme Court ruling. We learned what it could mean at home here in Wisconsin. Call in with a question or comment along the way, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We discuss ripple effects on college campuses after the Supreme Court's ruling banning race as a factor in university admissions, saying it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Call in with a question, a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Chronicle of Higher Education's senior journalist Eric Hoover as our guide. Let's go to Janet in Burlington. Janet, hi. What comes up for you?
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Hoover. The question I have is that I don't think that what the Supreme Court ruled was a good idea, that perhaps minority students may not have access to the better schools that their Caucasian other students might have had. And I was wondering, well, how you feel about that, that maybe they should still have the advantage of the affirmative action.
Janet,
right.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Eric.
All right. Thanks, Kate. Thank you for your comment and question, Janet. I mean, I don't wear an opinion hat here, but I take your question as an important one, your comment. And I can tell you that many, many people who work in higher education, many school counselors and college counselors who work with underrepresented populations would agree with you. They would say, for sure, this is a terrible decision that will be a setback for racial equity in this country that will have a extremely negative and perhaps drastically negative effect on the enrollment of underrepresented minority students. Because as you point out, and it's very important, race in this country certainly is entwined with racial inequity, is entwined with socioeconomic inequity and education inequity. And it's generally true that underrepresented minority students are not on equal footing when it comes to who's had which advantages, who has had the benefit of attending well-resourced, well-funded schools. And so this will continue to be a challenge for colleges. It already was. And now that challenge has gotten even greater because the Supreme Court decision might have changed the landscape. But the inequities that existed last Wednesday, the day before the ruling, still exist, right? Those inequities are not going away. And in fact, the effects of them will probably become more pronounced in the years ahead.
The Biden administration has given the Department of Education 45 days to outline legal ways for universities to encourage diversity. What are you watching for there? What clarity or what tools would help colleges?
Yeah, that's a great question. Everyone is eagerly awaiting that guidance. And I think one thing that colleges and university officials are looking for is some sort of assurance about the value of diversity and therefore any institutional strategies that support it. Yes, this one tool, and it's a big tool, it's significant. The tool called race-conscious admissions has been removed from colleges' toolkits, but it is not the only tool. And there are other tools in there. You and I talked just a couple minutes ago about race-conscious scholarships. I think that is one of the key questions that colleges will be hoping to see answered in this guidance. But what if we have a race-conscious scholarship program? Is that still okay? Many highly selective colleges have targeted recruitment and outreach programs. They have fly-in programs that bring underrepresented students to campus to get a feel for the place. Those have race-conscious elements. Are those still okay? And if so, how do colleges perhaps need to think about adjusting them, the language they use to describe them, what strategies, if any, will be taken off the table? I think those are the big ones. Race-conscious admissions is gone. Race conscious, everything else. What will the government tell? What will the education department tell colleges about the new lay of the land, and how different will that look from the lay of the land colleges knew up until late last week?
Let's bring in Gary now in Ripon. Gary, hi. Go ahead.
Yes, my observation would be that these elite institutions don't want to comply with the Supreme Court ruling. So where the cost is coming in is they're going to do a lot of workarounds in order to make it sort of look like they're complying, even though they're not.
Gary, thank you. Do you anticipate different workarounds, Eric?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for your comment, Gary. I guess I'd say, sure. Colleges are going to be developing workarounds. And in many cases, these will not be brand new strategies. They will just be bolstered strategies, right? Or revised strategies, enhanced strategies, if you will. I would say that the word workaround, is tricky. Colleges will be looking for ways to adjust. Any college or university that's looking for a backdoor kind of workaround, right? A loophole, a way to get around the weight of the Supreme Court decision. Well, Chief Justice Roberts, in his majority opinion, warned colleges and universities that they cannot do that. And any institution that tries to get around the force of this opinion and the meaning of this decision will put itself at great risk, right, of losing federal funding, of finding itself in the middle of the next lawsuit. And so, yes, I do think adjustment is the key word. That's what colleges will be doing and then some. But getting around the opinion itself does not seem to be a viable option.
Can we just dip our toe into legacy admissions here in our final moments? The civil rights groups, sued Harvard over the benefit it gives to children of graduates who are known as legacy applicants, and groups like the NAACP and Lawyers for Civil Rights, they argue that this gives an unfair advantage to white people. Can you talk about that? How big of an advantage is legacy admissions?
Yeah, well, we know from all the information that came out in the lawsuit against Harvard that legacy advantage, at least at that institution, and it's true at many others, is a substantial plus for an applicant. They are many times more likely to be admitted if they are a legacy, right? And by and large, the vast majority of applicants who are legacies are going to be white applicants, and most of them, if not nearly all of them, will come from affluent families. So yes, many people who supported race-conscious admissions are saying right now, wait a minute, what about this advantage? What about this substantial plus? How do we deal with that? I don't know that immediately anyway, a legal challenge will force colleges and universities to abandon legacy admissions. What happened this week is just a complaint that was filed and not like a lawsuit. But I do think and suspect that the force of public opinion, and I would say I detect a growing disgust with legacy advantages in college admissions. That'll compel colleges, in the court of public opinion, if you will. I think there's a growing case to be made against legacy admissions.
Thank you for joining us. Eric Hoover, senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.